Hello, hello. Welcome back to Loki's Library, and if you are new here, welcome. I am your librarian, Katrina, and this is where I am reading through the enormous library books you see behind me, and then I give you a quick synopsis and tell you what I think about them. So if you like books, just aren't sure what to read next, hit that subscribe button, like, and share my videos, and let me know what you think in the comments. This month, I am reverting back to a theme, sort of. The theme is the 1930s and the colossal fuck-up that was the Roosevelt administration. We are starting this exploration with this week's book, The Forgotten Man, A New History, just switch that way, A New History of the Great Depression by Amity Schlaes. The accompanying cocktail is called The Insidious Punch of Washington. I thought that was a appropriate cocktail. It is one part sour lemonade, one part champagne, half part rum, and half part of whiskey, sweetened with a dash of sweet liqueur of your choice. Serve it over ice. So let's do this. Schlaes quite wisely starts her book with two, I'm a little disturbed by how easily that opened, with two diametrically opposed quotes on the forgotten man. She starts with Roosevelt's quote from his 32 campaign. The quote from Roosevelt is, quote, "These unhappy times call for the building of plans that rest upon the forgotten, the unorganized but the indispensable units of economic power, for plans like those of 1917 that built from the bottom up and not from the top down, that put their faith once more in the forgotten man at the bottom of the economic pyramid." So he made the forgotten man mean the poor, basically. The poor and the destitute, the ones who are at the bottom of the economic period, the wage slaves, for lack of a better terminology, from these idiots over in Washington. Now, I'm always leery of champagne. Roosevelt cribbed that from a half-remembered quote 50 years before in 1883. Now, he didn't just crib it. He literally straight up stole it, and stole it incorrectly. He did not use that in the way it was intended at all. I'm going to let that die down a minute. The original quote was from William Graham Sumner. I think he was a Yale University professor. At least the quote was from his time at Yale. Whether that was as a researcher or administrator, I don't know. But the quote is, "As soon as A observes something which seems to him to be wrong, from which X is suffering, A talks it over with B, and A and B then propose to get a law passed to remedy the evil and help X. Their law always proposes to determine what C shall do for X, or in the better case, what A, B, and C shall do for X. What I want to do is look up C. I want to show you what manner of man he is. I call him the forgotten man. Perhaps the appellation is not strictly correct. He is the man who is never thought of. He works, he votes, he generally prays, but he always pays." You see, X is you and me. When you're taken in the correct context of the original quote, you get the sense of what this book is going to cover. The forgotten man is not the poor man at the bottom of the economic pyramid. The forgotten man is the one who is expected to pay for whatever A and B decide is needed for the welfare and benefit of C. A and B being Roosevelt and his administrators and the Congress critters. Those are A and B. X is the welfare state they built like mad in the 1930s, and C is you and me and every other taxpayer in the United States who are basically just doing our best to get along with what these assholes have put before us. Good times, good times. And sometimes X is, in fact, the ultra-wealthy who are put on the hook to pay for social programs via prohibitive income taxes. But usually the forgotten man is you and me. It's anyone whose tax dollars are being used to pay for programs and wars they don't agree with. And this book starts actually in 1927, January of 1927, before any of the, I'm almost done with this bottle of whiskey. I have some left there. I have enough left to keep around another week. Not enough I feel like I should just down it and call it good. So January 1927, before the crash, before Hoover was even president, unemployment was at 3.3%. Nationally, the Dow Jones was sitting at a relatively healthy 155. It was during the floods of 1927 that Hoover really shot to the front of national prominence. This is just a splash of sweet. So, and just 7 months later, in July of 1927, The Dow Jones has continued to climb. It's actually at 168. And the core of what will become Roosevelt's brain trust was traveling to Russia to see what Stalin was doing with the USSR. And that core included Rexford Guy Tugwell, John Bartlett Brebner, Stuart Chase, F.J. Schlink, Carlos Israels, Silas Axel, James Hudson Moore, John Brophy, Albert Coyle. There were others, but this core was going to be his brain trust during his first couple of administrations. And this dream team was the first unofficial envoy to the USSR, which had not been recognized by the United States as a nation. Coolidge refused to do so, and Hoover would refuse to do so. And they came back all a-twitter over how amazing life in Russia was. And this despite the fact that several of their own anarchist heroes from the United States, including Emma Goldman, had walked away from Russia in disgust by the time this junket had made their way to the country, to this country. It's, well, I mean, it's drinkable. It's drinkable. Holy cow. Well, probably not my favoriteest cocktail ever, but it's not revolting. The junket determined, and this was backed up by USSR, that family didn't matter. That in the new and improved USSR, family wasn't relevant. And there are some very odd parallels with what happened during the trip 100 years ago and a lot of what you hear today, especially in social media. The parallels are quite alarming. Family doesn't matter. Children should only be taught by schools, not by public schools, not by parents. There's a lot of pushback against the homeschooling movements, which thank God are fighting back quite effectively. Back to this book, from there, Schley starts to dismantle several of the enduring myths of the Great Depression, starting with the myth that suicide spiked as a result of the market crash. Now, she doesn't deny that some people did commit suicide. You really can't deny it. It literally happened. There were news stories about it. But the stories of such were outliers. They were spectacular indications of a moment in time, but not the norm. Most people were not. Most of them were just one foot in front of the other, planning their way forward. They were not, in fact, symptoms of the time. I actually get slightly better with each sip. I'm betting that's the punch, actually. It's kind of insidious. You don't actually taste the alcohol or the burn, but you know, with, you know, a combination of champagne, whiskey, and rum, this is going to beat the tar out of you later, which is why it's insidious. She does a bit of a deeper dive into what Hoover did wrong. It wasn't particular. I mean, the book I read last week or 2 weeks ago on Hoover did cover this, but she did a deeper dive into it. She does not like Hoover. She stops just short of calling him a Nazi sympathizer, which I don't believe he was. From the Hoover book, he did meet with Hitler, but he was not impressed with Hitler, and he warned England on his way back through that, hey, this guy is preparing for war, and he's going to be ready in 18 months. So he was not a Nazi sympathizer, and I don't think he liked Germany as much as she seems to think he did, but he did a lot wrong, including freezing wages. And in a time when there's suddenly no money coming into a business owner has to choose between cutting wages or laying people off. We had a very real-life example of that a couple of years ago. Hoover basically forced owners into this stasis, and that ushered in the financial woes of the next decade. As anybody will tell you, the real minimum wage isn't whatever the federal government says it is. The real minimum wage is zero because employers don't actually have to hire anybody, and they don't have to keep anybody on staff. They can, in fact, lay people off. And that's what happened frequently when they became unable to just cut wages. That they had to lay people off, and unemployment spiked, and it continued to climb, and it would stay in the 20 and 30% range for almost all of the 1930s, starting with Hoover's policies, but certainly continuing with Roosevelt's. And you very much get the impression in this book that part of the reason that Roosevelt hated Hoover so much is that so many of the programs that Roosevelt would rocket to the top of his administration were actually started under Hoover. In the more rural areas of the country, specifically cited in the book was Utah, they literally reinstituted a barter system. And this is something that absolutely kills me when you see people who are like, oh, why don't we all just grow neighborhood crops and then we can trade with each other in the barter system. That's called capitalism, folks. Just that's basic capitalism. The reason that pieces of paper became easier, I mean, not just because the government sucks, but because it's easier to transport pieces of paper over whole chickens and pigs and cows, right? So Salt Lake City actually began printing their own currency called Valor, which V-A-L-L-A-R, which were used in barter in town and were accepted as payment with all of the local stores and throughout chunks of Utah. And that's not so different, incidentally, from stores these days opting to accept cryptocurrency. They can accept any kind of currency they like. If a store wants to accept barter, they can. This is why the IRS took them a few years, but they finally jumped on the bandwagon of taxing cryptocurrency. So thank you for that. That is like the most neutral cocktail I have ever had. It almost tastes like nothing. Like the first sip wasn't awesome, but having let it sit for just a minute for the flavors to mix, there's like nothing there. You can barely taste anything, which means I'll probably be completely slurring and drunk by the time this is over. Hoover, of course, signed the disastrous Smoot-Hawley tariff, which added fuel to the global depression, despite bankers and economists literally begging him to veto it. And then in November 1932, Hoover lost to Roosevelt, and in the intervening 4 months, Hoover tried to ask Roosevelt on several policy plans what Roosevelt's stance was, and was ignored. Roosevelt wanted no part of it. And what kills me reading things like this, and the outgoing president is still president. He is president until the new guy is sworn in. It literally rests on him. He could have done anything. Anything would have been better than doing the nothing, which is what he did. He did nothing, and Roosevelt was just so fucking arrogant. He literally wanted the country, and I think she had like quotes in here from some of Roosevelt's nearest and dearest confidants, that he wanted the country to be as bad as it could possibly get before he took over, which is just disgusting. So by October 1933, he was the last president to have his first term begin on March 4th before the amendment took over and moved it to January. So 7 months in, he's like 7 months into his first term, and Roosevelt is setting a target price for gold. Like, based on no real evidence, he would just pick a number. Literally, he one time said, we'll set it at $21 because it's 3 times 7 and that's a lucky number. And his sycophantic yes men would just agree with him. And he's the one who decided to just arbitrarily remove the United States from the gold standard. Only lasted a few months because a panic ensued as a result of that. His NRA, which is the National Recovery Act, and the AAA, Agricultural Adjustment Administration, both of these plans were abject failures. She explores these in depth in this book. Both of these were brought to lawsuits. The suit for the NRA went all the way to the Supreme Court. I feel like the AAA one did too. The administration ultimately lost, and that was a big part of the story. The NRA court case was between the Brooklyn Schechters and the NRA. The Schechters were kosher butchers. And this section was actually incredibly informative because most people like hear the word kosher butcher or halal butcher, for example, and they think, oh, this just, you know, that just means it's butchered under religious right. Well, actually, no, there's a lot more that goes into being a kosher butcher. In this case, the reason the Schechters were targeted is because they were literally the middlemen, the ex in Sumner's original analogy of the Forgotten Man, and Roosevelt's admin hated middlemen, hated them. The NRA code that specifically applied to the Schechters was that if someone came into their shop to buy a chicken, they had to buy the first chicken that came to hand, though picking what chicken they wanted. And here's the rub. Other than this is literally mandating poor customer service in the name of fairness, part of a kosher butcher's job is to inspect the meat for disease. That's what makes it kosher. It's not just that it's killed under a rabbi's sanction or anything like that. It was part of their health code. And the diseases may not actually be obvious when a bird is alive. For example, tuberculosis. I didn't know this, but apparently one of the ways tuberculosis spread is via contaminated meat. Who fucking knew? And the infection would be obvious on inspecting the lung tissue during a kosher butchering. And they were told, no, can't do that. You have to kill the first one, and that's the one the guy gets, and there's no arguing with it. And if a customer came in and said they wanted a specific bird, the Schechters would apologize and say that they were under the code and that violated the code and they weren't able to. This would cause them to lose customers. Now, during their first trial locally, which they ultimately lost, the Schechters pointed out that the NRA inspectors were too difficult to work with. The one specifically in the trial was Philip Alampi, and he would argue with the Schechters' customers and insult them. This is a direct quote. He told the customer that he is full of shit, and I am the code authority, and I get a right to do anything I want, and if you don't like it, get out. End quote. Isn't that just typical of a government man? You give a petty bureaucrat a bit of power, and he turns into a dictatorial asshole. Now, the code, as written, did not make sense, and the Schechters knew that. And the Schechters lost their first day at the state level. They lost their first state case locally. See, I told you I'm going to start slurring soon. They're second at the state level, but it went ultimately all the way to the Supreme Court, and the justices voted, I think it was unanimously, in favor of the Schechters, which ultimately led to the expiration of the NRA program. But it put the Supreme Court in the crosshairs of FDR, who was already a petty, vindictive prick. And following the administration's loss on the Schechter case in the NRA, FDR started talking about packing the court with up to 15 justices who would all be beholden to him. Now, this plan backfired in a haze of public opinion, much like Biden's statements to the same effect did, right? Public opinion was heavy against him. What the hell are you doing? Don't you dare pack that court. Unfortunately for the 1930s America, some of the justices felt that threat and started voting more in favor with FDR's policies. Now, on our end, the justices actually started voting unanimously on things as a giant fuck you, which, you know, whether you agree with them or not, I appreciate their stance. I don't know that they should be making law based on their on that sort of opinion, but I appreciate their point. I'm going off topic here. I'm going way off topic here. What was not subject to public opinion was the administration's malicious persecution of former Secretary of Treasury Andrew Mellon and Samuel Insull, who helped build some of America's infrastructure. Both had filed taxes quite legally, using legal tax loopholes. The administration felt those loopholes should not exist, and rather than close the loopholes, they persecuted those who used them. Because he's a malicious, vindictive prick. And what's really ironic is the tax code back then was so convoluted that even Roosevelt had a problem determining what he owed. There's actually literally a picture of a letter in here that he sent to the IRS saying, hey, I couldn't quite figure out, maybe you should just forgive me any errors. But at the same time, he would insist that the IRS prosecute others for errors, because while Roosevelt's was from genuine confusion, everyone else was because they were trying to defraud the government. He was a real peach of a human being. And despite this malicious prosecution, Mellon still donated funds and building and the initial artwork for the National Gallery in D.C. Most people don't know that. Andrew Mellon is why we have a National Gallery in D.C. And he did that with no expectation that charges would be dropped. He was basically just trying to outclass Roosevelt, which he did spectacularly. This book did an excellent job highlighting the stories that so frequently go untold during the Depression. It goes over the epic struggle between private business entities and government encroachment where it should not be. It discusses how the New Deal accomplished nothing but make work. It hired less people than is usually given credit for, and discusses in depth how petty, vindictive, and small-minded Roosevelt was. It discusses how the reason the Depression dragged on for a decade is that Roosevelt's New Deal did nothing for the people of America beyond making them feel like something was being done. She discusses Rex Tugwell's, the Reclamation Administration? I think it's the Reclamation Administration. Hold on. I'm going to look it up. Hold on. Resettlement Administration, where basically he wanted to make a farm in Arizona, of all places, which is not exactly the bestest farming country. It's a desert. Trust me, I've been there. And, my hands are getting fidgety. At one point, the people who were hired to work on this farm said, hey, we could actually produce more, be more productive if we used a machine to milk the cows. And like 3 out of the 4 of them were fired because they were basically volunteering to find other work around the farm. And they were like, no, you were hired to milk these cows, milk the damn cows. Like there was no motivation to do better, to produce more, to earn money, because that would cause you to lose dollars, that sweet government green. It's disgusting. It really highlighted how Roosevelt was the first in a long line of politicians to make use of the new media. I mean, Hoover technically gave the first address via radio, but Roosevelt really made that his own, and he used it to spread his message. And that, in turn, got him elected 4 damn times. It was an interesting read on many levels, because as I sit with what I learned in this book, I see so many alarming parallels between what happened 100 years ago and what's happening today. And I see how the politicians of today use the new media, social media, to push their message and drive division and class warfare, a class warfare that did not exist prior to Roosevelt telling those at the bottom of the economic pyramid that they should feel hatred towards anyone that was better off than them. There's really no need for that. All right. Everybody has a chance here. We are all born equal. We all have the opportunity to do better, to be better, to build something better. And some people choose to build hatred in their hearts for somebody else who is doing something with their life. And Roosevelt fed that. He fed that flame. There was a lot of information to process in this book, and I'm going to be processing it for a while. If you want to understand how counterproductive Roosevelt's policies were, I recommend it. And that's it for this week. If you like what you saw, don't forget to subscribe, and I will see you guys next Sunday. Bye.